Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Caroline Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, What's New in Precision Medicine? And today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And we have on the program today over 200 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, Colombia, Germany, Greece, Nigeria, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Aaron Goldberg, and Dr. Goldberg is Assistant Attending Physician, Leukemia Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Goldberg will be addressing Understanding Precision Medicine, Overview and Value of Precision Medicine, and how precision medicine is different from targeted treatments. And he'll also discuss the role of precision medicine in deciding treatment for leukemia. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I just want to start by thanking Cancer Care Connect for organizing this workshop and for their commitment to education and support for people affected by cancer. And most importantly, I want to thank all of you, patients, caregivers, family members, and loved ones for being here. You know, you're obviously all navigating something difficult, personal, sometimes overwhelming, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. It's a privilege. Thank you so much. You know, my goal for the next few minutes is to help explain what precision medicine is, how it's different from targeted therapy, and why it plays such an important role in deciding treatment for cancer and in particular leukemia. So we can start with the term precision medicine because it can sound intimidating, but at its core, precision medicine really is about choosing treatment based upon an individualized assessment of the best treatment for this particular person and for the specific biology of the person's cancer rather than treating everyone the same way. We no longer take a one-size-fits-all approach. We really tailor our treatment to the individual and even to the subtype of their particular cancer. You know, in the past, in leukemia, for example, we used to make decisions based upon just, in general, what kind of leukemia they had. Not necessarily looking at the particular subtype, but in general, what kind of leukemia it was, how aggressive it looked under the microscope, and a person's age and overall health. And while those things still matter, we look much deeper today. So with precision medicine, we ask questions like, are there features that predict whether a treatment is more or less likely to work? How well is this person, is my patient, going to be able to tolerate the treatment I'm recommending? You know, what pathways are driving this particular cancer's growth? And what genetic changes are present in the leukemia cells? So leukemia cells often carry DNA changes. You might hear them called mutations. These are not something that a person is born with typically, but and not something that it was, you know, their fault. It's really something that developed over time in the cancer cells themselves. And with precision medicine, we can use advanced testing, often from blood or bone marrow samples, to identify those genetic changes and use that information to guide care. Now, how does this differ from precision medicine from targeted therapy? So they're not exactly the same. Precision medicine is really more like the overall strategy, kind of the roadmap. It's the overall approach to taking how do I get the best outcome for this person. And it's also the process of analyzing the leukemia. But targeted therapy is really more specific. Under the sort of the umbrella of precision medicine, it's one type of treatment that can come out of that strategy. So a targeted therapy really is a drug that's designed to block a particular abnormal protein or signal that leukemia cells depend on. And sometimes not all precision medicine leads to targeted therapy. There may not be, for example, a specific mutation for which we have a targeted treatment available. But sometimes a precision medicine approach may lead to a targeted therapy. So precision medicine is really a broader strategy than targeted treatment. It's really about making smarter, kind of more personalized, individualized decisions. And I would say that leukemia really is an area where precision medicine has had the greatest impact. So for many patients, testing the leukemia's genetic features really helps to answer some really critical questions, like what treatments are most likely to work, how intensive does the treatment need to be, and should we consider, for example, a clinical trial? Often clinical trials may be able to give new targeted therapies to a patient where, you know, conventionally there may not be a specific therapy, and we may otherwise previously have taken a one-size-fits-all approach. So the other thing that I should emphasize is that precision medicine is not like a one-time event. Leukemia can change over time, sometimes in response to treatment. So repeat testing and at every time point of the patient's treatment journey, thinking about, you know, what is the best treatment for this patient at this time is really appropriate to guide the next steps. I'll give one example of how precision medicine and really within precision medicine, targeted therapy can be useful in leukemia. About a third of patients with acute myeloid leukemia have a genetic change in their leukemia in a gene called FLT3 or FLT3. And it turns out that if you just give these patients chemotherapy, they don't do as well as you would hope. But more recently, there are now inhibitors of this specific mutated protein called FLT3 inhibitors that actually even work better to help patients live longer and do better than if they were given even a multi-cocktail of chemotherapy. So that's how really taking a precision medicine approach to then identify a particular target therapy can be very useful. The other thing I want to close with is that this is a lot to take in. You're going to hear a lot of unfamiliar terms, gene names, mutation results, risk categories, and it can feel overwhelming. And the key take-home point is that you're not alone in this. You're not expected to understand all this on your own. This is where your healthcare team comes in. You know, we should be talking with you, explaining, you know, what was tested, what was found, how it affects your treatment plan, and asking questions is not only okay. We encourage that. That's how people do the best. And so, in closing, I would say that precision medicine is really, it's really transformed how we approach leukemia care by allowing us to better understand each person's disease and tailor treatment accordingly. You know, for example, thinking through, is this patient a candidate for a stem cell transplant, or not? Is this the best treatment for that person? Is there a targeted therapy available or not? And while this kind of individualized approach does not eliminate uncertainty, it helps us to make more informed and more personalized decisions, and I think can really give us a lot more hope than we had before. So I want to close with that, and thank you again to Cancer Care Connect, and thank you to patients and caregivers for your time and your trust, and looking forward to continuing the conversation. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Goldberg. That was a stellar presentation, and since you were the first speaker, you started off the whole presentation today, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Just thank you for just a superb presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael B. Foote, and Dr. Foote is Assistant Attending Physician, Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Foote will be addressing precision medicine's role in informing treatment decisions, predicting response to treatment, and the role of precision medicine in determining the treatment for colon cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Foote.
Hi, thank you so much, and it's wonderful to be here with everybody. I'm really quite honored and big shoes, of course, to go after Dr. Goldberg, and I think he's had such a wonderful explanation of the philosophy of precision medicine, and of course I agree completely. I thought I would talk a little bit about how precision medicine can help guide treatment decisions, and because I'm a doctor who treats patients with gastrointestinal cancers like colon cancer, pancreas cancer, I thought it might apply it to those diseases. And I certainly echo Dr. Goldberg's sentiment that, our role here is to, of course, help our patients and treat them, but also I think to educate them too, because these are extremely complicated topics, and you know, we get confused about them, and I won't even tell you how much school we've had to go through, and I still get confused every day. So, you know, it's very normal to feel a little overwhelmed, and you know, our job is to really try to make it all make sense for you. So I just would encourage everyone to ask questions, you know, to their doctor, make sure they understand what's going on, because I find that my patients have a much better experience with their cancer journey when they have a good sense of the plan and why they're on a different medicine. So precision medicine, like we talked about, is really looking at different clues of your individual cancer and trying to understand what about your particular cancer would work well with a specific treatment, or if we could help predict its trajectory, even independent of treatment, into the future. And a lot of the biomarkers that we use in gastrointestinal cancers are looking at the DNA of the cancer cell, so looking at the basic information that makes that cancer cell a cancer, and looking at changes in that DNA that are called mutations. Now, some of these changes in the DNA turn into proteins. So proteins are all over the body, of course, and some of these proteins that cancer manipulates are involved in making the cancer cell grow more, or maybe gives the cancer a superpower, like the ability to spread to a new area of the body. So these are very important changes that the cancer goes through. I sometimes use the analogy of X-Men. You know, X-Men have superpowers because they're mutants, and cancer similarly gets its superpowers because of mutation. So every patient that has a gastrointestinal cancer really should be getting genetic sequencing if the tumor is at an advanced stage where it's traveled to another part of the body. And increasingly, and this is very important, increasingly we are now starting to genetically sequence the tumors of patients even when they haven't spread. Or in other words, if you have an early stage cancer, like a stage 1, a stage 2, a stage 3 cancer, where the tumor has not left where it really started, but we are trying to find more information about that, and particularly, honestly, stage 2 and stage 3. So that is a major advance, especially in colorectal cancer, because we're starting to see new drugs enter the early stages of a patient's journey. And I'm going to give you some examples. So I'm going to start off with a really exciting success story that we're very proud of here at Memorial that I was very privileged to work with. So I do research into how these genomic features, like the DNA mutations, the superpowers, make the cancer do what it does, become aggressive, evade the immune system. And working with Dr. Andrea Sirsik, Dr. Luis Diaz, and myself, we were able to find that patients that have a very specific genetic superpower called mismatch repair deficiency, patients with rectal cancer that had this very specific superpower, when they were in an early stage cancer, so a stage 2 or stage 3 rectal cancer that had not spread, when they were given an immunotherapy drug called dostarlimab, this very specific population of people had 100% of their tumors disappear, which was virtually unprecedented in the history of cancer. It was an amazing phenomenon, and you may have heard about it in the news. And the really exciting part for these folks is that instead of having to go through chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, which would be the normal treatments for their tumor, they just had the immunotherapy drug, and then they were, you know, virtually cured from that. So this is just this is an extreme, you know, example, but an example of how important it can be to look for those types of superpowers, like mismatch repair deficiency, on your tumor. And if you have an early stage colorectal cancer, you know, your doctor should be looking to see whether that tumor is mismatch repair deficient. And this can be done with a simple protein test on the tumor, and it's available across the country. You know, another example for patients that have cancers that have maybe spread beyond where they started, so patients that have metastatic disease, a very exciting development in the gastrointestinal cancer world is the development of drugs called KRAS inhibitors, or KRAS inhibitors. KRAS is one of these proteins that when mutated, the cancer cell gets the superpower of being able to grow faster. And for a very long time, scientists have been trying to develop drugs against this protein, but it was a very sneaky protein that was very difficult to destroy. And in the last few years, some brilliant scientists in San Francisco and other places have developed drugs. And now KRAS drugs are all over for pancreas cancer, for colorectal cancer. And there's lots and lots and lots of clinical trials out for this. So this is a very exciting development. And it's something that every patient who has stage 4 disease, we really should be looking to see what mutations they have, what superpowers their cancer has. Because it can, if they have that superpower, the KRAS superpower, the cancer uses that for its own evil ends, but we have a drug to stop that. It's like an Achilles heel. So, and then the last thing I'll say before I cede the floor is, we know that doing this test to figure out the genetics, the mutational superpowers of a tumor, can help for the reasons I've explained. So we do it for everybody once. But I will tell you, there's an evolving philosophy, just like Dr. Goldberg said, that as the cancer grows, as it changes over time, it might not be a bad idea, even in colorectal cancer, to send the test again later in a patient's journey. Because sometimes you see development of mutations that allow the cancer to sneak around a certain therapy. And sometimes it actually allows us to retreat patients with earlier therapies if a mutation is not present. And KRAS is a very good example of that. And I could probably talk for an hour about this, so I don't want to take too much more of our time. But I just want to mention, I'm so thankful to be here with you. Please, if you have not gotten genetic testing on your tumor, ask your oncologist about it. Of course, very happy to answer questions later.
Thank you so much, Dr. Foote. That was just an extraordinary presentation, stellar in every way, and lots of information. I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer A. Marks, and Dr. Marks is instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, affiliate staff, Brigham and Women's Hospital medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology. And Dr. Marks will be talking with your healthcare team about precision medicine and its benefits and the role of precision medicine in determining the treatment of lung cancer. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Marks.
Hi there. Thank you so much for the invitation to present. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I want to help you feel more comfortable and more confident having conversations with your healthcare team about precision medicine as it relates to lung cancer specifically. So looking at precision medicine through this lens, really the meaning here is that we are able to tailor treatment based on the biology of your specific tumor. Not just the fact that it's for a lung cancer, as lung cancer isn't one single disease. Two people can have both, have lung cancers, and really their cancers might be driven by different changes inside of the cancer cells inherently. And so precision medicine in this aspect helps us to really identify what's driving your cancer so that we can choose the most effective treatment to really give you and inform outcomes in the future or potential other lines of treatment that you might have available to you. So how do we get this information? Well, in precision medicine in this space, we tailor the treatment based on the actual biology of the tumor or the genomics of the tumor and how it's acquired this mutation or an alteration, or you'll also hear another term called activating driver alteration or mutation that we look for on a variety of different tests. So one of our most common tests that we'll use is what's called next generation sequencing, or you'll see an abbreviation of NGS. And this is often tissue testing from really a biopsy sample or a surgical resection to really look at the tissue and see if there are these alterations or these things that we that will inform our treatment, these biomarkers. This testing can also include blood testing or on the plasma. You'll also hear this potentially termed liquid biopsy, where we're doing a similar approach to look for the genetic markers or biomarkers that relate from that are coming from the cancer that might be circulating in the bloodstream. This varies by practice, but it is becoming more common and a simple way to get a lot of information. But sometimes we need all of these tests to kind of coincide with one another and help us inform best treatment. Another essential test that we often use is called PD-L1. This is by an approach called immunohistochemistry, and this is really looking for a protein marker on the cancer cells themselves and looking for how much they express this protein. And really, with all this information in mind, we use this to help in four big ways inform precision medicine about lung cancer specifically. That firstly, targeted therapy. If we find a biomarker that the cancer depends on to survive, you might be eligible for a what's called targeted therapy. Often this can be a pill, but it's really addressing the specific driver of the cancer. And so for many patients, this target therapy can work very well, sometimes very quickly, with trying to absolutely minimize side effects, as this is more specific to the actual biology of the tumor. Secondly, we have immunotherapy, which we often use markers like PD-L1, that protein marker that really helps to determine how much we expect a response with either a single drug or combining that with chemotherapy. The third aspect here is that we like to really avoid, you know, less effective treatments, rather doing a trial and error kind of approach, and really find a match in terms of a treatment sooner rather than later that will get control of the cancer. Fourth, of all, clinical trials also are options here, and these are often informed by the biomarker testing previously mentioned that can open doors and match patients and their tumor to their profile of the tumor to a potential clinical trial. And so with all this being said, when do we start treatment? Well, at least in the very advanced setting, we often need this information to determine what that treatment is going to be up front. So it's very important that we get this information first to make sure that we're on the right approach going forward. We also, of course, if sometimes we get into a bind where we have to do something more urgently, and this is something that can be addressed with your medical oncologist as well. I know there's a few common worries that come up, and just to set the stage, if a patient does not have or you don't have a biomarker that we identify, this is not a means of blaming yourself. These changes are usually not caused by anything you did. Most are not inherited. These changes happen as from the tumor cells changing over time. And another question I often get is, if you don't have a targeted biomarker or a targetable biomarker, does this mean that we have nothing really available? And that's absolutely not the case. Many patients benefit greatly from chemotherapy or combination with immunotherapy, and there's plenty of approaches to getting all this information to inform the best initial therapy. So precision medicine is a powerful tool, but it's one tool among many. And with that, This is precision medicine works best when it's a partnership. So your healthcare team brings their expertise and you bring your goals and values. And we are happy to help you work through and navigate your treatment moving forward. So please ask questions with your oncologist, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions that may arise in the Q&A. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Marks. That was, again, a stellar presentation, really outstanding. And I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A. You explained a lot of detail, which I think our participants would find very, very helpful. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin will be addressing the role of precision medicine in determining the treatment for prostate cancer and how precision medicine contributes to treatment options and quality of life. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you so kindly, Dr. Mesner, and hello to everyone, and thank you for joining us. I think you've heard really excellent explanations about precision medicine, which we're all calling a personalized approach. But even if it is personalized, please keep in mind that when we meet patients with newly diagnosed or perhaps prostate cancer that has been resistant to treatment, that we are interested certainly in maintaining quality of life. We use standard of care treatments, as you all know, hormonal therapy, chemotherapy, even what we'd call radioligand therapy, otherwise known as PSMA-directed therapy. But you can have combinations of any of these with the idea of really trying to control the cancer and prolong life. But more importantly, what can we do to minimize the side effects and improve quality of life? Because let's face it, these are big hitters. These are not easy treatments, although they do have excellent side effect profiles. Nevertheless, there's always a patient who may not be able to tolerate it. So please keep in mind that as our goal in precision medicine, in terms of trying to really direct a care that is more personalized, no two cancers are the same, and not all treatments are the same. So when I say no two cancers are the same, please keep in mind that what we're really trying to do is we're trying to reduce the rates of over-treatment. We want to make sure that we're not giving you more treatment than you really need and that we are reducing side effects. So when I say no two cancers are the same, you can have patients who have the same Gleason score, the same PSA, the same level of medical issues, and of those two or three patients who come to see you, two are going to do well for years, 10, 15, 20, even 25 years, whereas one person may not have good responses to therapy, and therefore maybe they will have a harder time with newer treatments because their cancer is not responding, and hence the durability of their responses may be much shorter than other people. So when we try to figure out about a personalized treatment is how do we learn about the biologic behavior of that cancer? Are there factors or what we like to term, and you've heard it before, biomarkers that tell us their tumor is going to respond to the treatments? Are there factors in the bloodstream that we can measure? Is it that they have certain genetic alterations, such as the BRCA gene, BRCA, or breast cancer gene 2, that we see that a hefty number of patients with prostate cancer have, and for which targeted therapy with a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors for phosphoadenosyl, riboceyl phosphatase, these are drugs that work to stop the cancer cell from repairing the DNA and allowing the cancer to grow. But it works better in somebody who has a genetic or genomic alteration. So I think what's very important to take away in this very short time is how do we really decide who gets what, and how do we avoid overtreatment with more toxic agents? So number one, you've heard about molecular profiling. Is there a particular gene we can target? But in somebody who is newly diagnosed, for example, and is making a decision about whether surgery or radiation, we have now what we call Decipher scores, DECIPHER. It's really a 22 genes that when these genes are looked for on your specimen, that you are able to predict about what in 5 years is going to happen in terms of the development of metastatic disease. The Decipher score is based on a scale of 0 to 1, and anything greater than 0.6 is usually of concern. Excuse me. Now, while that is helpful, it is not absolute. No test is absolute in telling you when your cancer is going to come back or how slow or how fast. It is part of other biomarkers, if you want to call the whole group of markers that we use to predict. We look at histology, which means we look at the tumor under the microscope. We look at the tumor's genetic profile to see if there's anything that we want to target. But when we use the Decipher score, all it's doing is looking at 22 genes to tell us what's the likelihood that the cancer can come back. Now, why is it important? Because if somebody is doing very well and they're having no issues, that's great. That's a quality of life. But one of the downsides is that if you're told that in 5 years you have a 97.7% of your cancer coming back, you're living with the sword of Damocles over your head. You're scared. You're worried. What if? What if? I don't like that for my patient because the what ifs are not absolute. They are just conversational discussions that we have that you are at risk. That does not mean it's definitely going to come back in 5 years and one day. It just means that we need to follow you closely. Secondarily, there is another one. If you're going for radiation and we need to know whether or not hormonal therapy should be added, we have something called ARTERA, A-R-T-E-R-A. So a lot of what we do is now going to be based on artificial intelligence. We haven't gotten rid of the pathologists or the radiation doctors. We all work together because the more we learn about your tumor, the better we can treat you and hopefully keep you going a very long time with fewer side effects. So ARTERA itself is one of several different artificial intelligence programs. It's really multimodal, and when I say multimodal, it's based on multiple clinical trials from the radiation oncology literature, and it puts facts together. It puts the Gleason score, it puts together a variety of other factors, age, PSA, etc., to tell us what is the likelihood that you can have your cancer benefiting from the addition of hormonal therapy with radiation. So at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're using almost like a recipe, which, and within the recipe, as you know, are different things, a half a cup of this, a cup of that, 5 eggs. And that's what we do with this, what we call an algorithm, which is a recipe that tells you that there are different contributions of factors that go into determining what would be the best treatment for the patient. So what's the best treatment? Well, the ARTERA can come up to saying, well, you have a Gleason 7, let's add hormones for 6 months. No, you don't need it. It's a very low Gleason 7 in the sense that you don't have unfavorable risk factors, you have very small volume, and you can just get radiation and call it a day. Other ways of dealing with this is that we're trying to leverage a lot of different things. Nowadays, we do liquid biopsies in prostate. We look at genomic profiling, both those that are heritable, meaning that go on to your children, or the tumor itself. And in addition to using the PSMA PET scan to as a more sensitive and specific indicator, we are really going out of our way to demonstrate to patients that certain treatments may benefit you other than others. So I have patients who come in and say they want the kitchen sink, they want chemo, they want hormones, they want this, they want that. Nowadays, with all of these technologies, you do not need it. So what I would strongly tell you about all of this is that precision medicine is here to stay. It is not just a fancy term that we use because we have nothing to give you. It is one of many different approaches, and it's truly now become a standard of care. So if your doctor, as my colleagues have said in the other cancer groups, if your doctor has not done genomic profiling on you, that should be done. They should also do it not only to test your genes to see if your children are going to get any different types of genetic alterations, but also to check your cancer, because sometimes we have this microsatellite instability high, as we call it, MSI, which is very responsive to immunotherapy, and there's lots of things that are out there. So seeing a patient for the first time becomes really very complex for all of us, because it's not that we want to know about you, we want to know about your cancer. So I apologize if that's a short rendition, but I'm sure that all of you now can at least take home to your doctors, you know, how to best go forward with this kind of technology. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions. And back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sloman. That was a stellar presentation, outstanding in every way, with lots of information, and certainly for people living with prostate cancer and their families, very helpful to them. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Jesse Cox. Dr. Cox is with UNMC Pathology Residency Program Director, James Winder, MD Residency Director, Distinguished Professorship, Chair, Director, Tissue Typing, HLA Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine Director, Molecular Forensic Laboratory, UNC Medical Director, Nebraska Public Service Laboratory, UNMC Medical Director, Boys Town National Research Hospital, Omaha, Nebraska, Associate Director, Molecular Diagnostic Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine, Associate Professor, Department of Pathology and Microbiology, University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Cox is going to be addressing the role of a pathologist and open notes, asking your healthcare team and pathologists to help you understand open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cox.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. You didn't need to go through that entire laundry list of things. In brief, I'm a molecular pathologist, and so one of the big tasks that we're charged with in pathology is actually establishing diagnoses for our patients. So when you have a tumor or a mass or some sort of lesion that's of unknown origin, we're not quite sure what it is, when that surgeon or that proceduralist is going to take that tissue out, all of that tissue might find its way to the pathology laboratory. And so within the pathology laboratory, we're doing a few different things. So we're looking at your specimen grossly to try to determine what size is the cancer, where is the cancer invading, what are the characteristics of the cancer. And then what we'll do is we'll actually take samples of that tissue, put that tissue on slides, and then actually look at that tissue under the microscope. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to give a very specific name to whatever neoplastic process might be going on. So if you have a ductal adenocarcinoma, or if you have a lobular carcinoma of the breast, or if you have a Gleason 4+5, all of those terms and whatnot are determined by pathology. We also use a lot of different ancillary studies too to try to help classify tumors. So as a number of my other colleagues mentioned, we use different kind of protein markers. So different proteins that the cells within the tumor are expressing can help us understand where that cancer is coming from. We can also start to get an understanding of what the biology is driving that tumor. So would a particular cancer be amenable to utilizing your own immune system to help fight off those cancer cells if we give it just kind of a little bit of a kickstart? The other thing that pathology oversees is all of the molecular testing that's been discussed. So the discussion of liquid biopsies, the discussion of next generation sequencing, the discussion of determining point mutations, all of those activities are overseen by pathologists. Again, so that way you as a patient can feel confident in the results that you're getting and trust in the reports that are issued to your oncologist and treatment team. So all of these data basically get compiled into our pathology reports. And so if you've had, you know, a tumor sent off to the pathology department, and in your open notes portal, you're able to see what the pathologist has signed out and those types of things. Those reports contain a lot of information which help kind of frame and grade that tumor. The reason why we do that is so then that way we can provide an optimal treatment kind of going down the road. One of the things I always encourage patients to do, if they have any questions about a report, and I know that oftentimes you'll see these reports prior to going to oncology to discuss with your oncologist, take those questions to your oncologist, and if you still have questions, feel free to reach out to the pathologist. All of us as pathologists are physicians. We've gone through medical school. We understand the medical system and those types of things, and we're more than happy to discuss the things that we're seeing underneath the microscope. The other thing that we'll do in pathology is we actually monitor a patient's status over time. So in particular, things like blood cancer, so like leukemias and lymphomas, we're doing a lot of testing to basically get people ready to go for their next steps of treatment. So if they go on to, say, like a bone marrow transplant, we're working in our laboratories to help identify bone marrow donors. And we're also looking at subsequent follow-up samples, again, making sure that we're not seeing any evidence of residual disease. Or if we do see evidence of recurrent disease, what characteristics do those new tumor cells have that could be exploited, at least in treatment, kind of going forward? The long and short of this whole discussion is it's a very complex kind of topic, especially at a time when there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of new terms being thrown around, plus you have this kind of overarching diagnosis of cancer. Just realize that there are people out there available to you to help answer those questions and help kind of guide you through all of the steps in this very uncertain time. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Messner and be happy to take any questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Cox. That's a wonderful, stellar presentation. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. I'm just going to say a few words about, just talk for 2 minutes about cancer care services, just so you have access to them. Cancer Care is offers free national programs and services. We have a HOPE line, 800-813-4673, and a website, www.cancercare.org. And you might want to ask, what do we actually help people with? Well, many people contact us for help with transportation, practical and financial assistance, online support groups, navigation services, and a host of other services. And if you go to our website, you'll be able to see all the different services that we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try and take as many of your questions as possible. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is an interesting question. Why is precision, this question I'm going to direct to Dr. Cox. Why is precision medicine applicable to some cancers and not others?
So depending upon what's identified within the tumor, some findings are associated with those kind of targeted therapies and those particular characteristics and therapies that will address those kind of underlying biological drivers. Sometimes, at least at this point in time, some tumors we can't find anything that's, quote, actionable. And so in those circumstances, what we'll do is just kind of default back to the kind of standard of this is the specific tumor type that you have. These are the treatments that we have used historically, and these are the information that we know, at least expected, of how those tumors kind of should respond. So a lot of it's driven based upon what we see or what we don't see. I will say, you know, in the last 15 to 20 years, the number of targets and the number of sites that we're looking at and investigating has grown exponentially. So in the early days of molecular diagnostics and whatnot, we were looking at only one gene at a time. So you could imagine that it's very labor intensive. We can only look at a small subset of particular genes just because of the limited amounts of tissue that we have. But fast forward today, and it's fairly routine, at least in a lot of these next generation sequencing assays, to look at hundreds of targets all at one time. And so as technology evolves and whatnot, that type of finding where there is nothing, quote, actionable should probably diminish over time.
Thank you so much. A question for Dr. Goldberg. How do treatments that target proteins work? Is there a risk of targeting non-cancer cells?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with every treatment, obviously, there are always risks and versus benefits. And part of the process of drug development is really to try to develop drugs, if you're talking about a targeted therapy, that are ideally as specific as possible for a particular target. And ideally, it should be a target that is, you know, either at higher levels in the cancer cell or maybe even specific to the cancer cell. So in that example of that FLT3 FLT3 inhibitor that I mentioned, this is the FLT3 protein is an enzyme that's like signaling within the cancer cell to signal to make the cancer cell grow more. And these enzyme inhibitors, these drugs, are designed so that they actually bind to that active enzyme, that active protein, and they try to turn it off or turn it down, and ideally turn that signaling off. But you know, with every drug, there's always some risk of sort of off-target toxicities. But the goal with a successful drug development is to try to make those, you know, the risk-benefit profile as good as possible, so that the drug is really as specific as possible for the cancer. There's no perfect drug, no perfect medicine, but most of the modern drugs that are developed really are approved because, you know, collectively it's been shown that the benefits outweigh the risks.
Excellent, thank you. And a question for Dr. Goldberg, what resources are available to learn more about precision medicine and how it can be applied to my disease?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll speak for leukemia, and then I'll give the other presenters the opportunity to speak for their different diseases. So, you know, every series of cancers, often there are these patient advocacy groups who are just outstanding, and organizations who've developed a lot of great resources in terms of education. So for leukemia and for lymphoma and for blood cancers, this used to be called the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Now it's called Blood Cancer United, an outstanding organization that has a lot of educational material about all kinds of different blood cancers and diseases and the various types of treatments, including target treatments that are relevant there. And maybe I'll turn it over to my colleagues about other relevant organizations and their disease subsets.
Anyone else like to add to this?
So I'm going to just jump in. It's Susan Slobin. So for prostate cancer, Prostate Cancer Foundation is an excellent resource. American Cancer Society, and of course, Cancer Care is very helpful. And also for patients, there are publications from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN, which provides a lot of information for patients as opposed to the physicians. So that's our usual resources.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Marks, do you want to comment as well?
Sure. I would say Longevity has a patient education series on biomarker testing that's available to download. There's also GRACE, which stands for Global Resource of Advancing Cancer Education, and they often do presentations geared towards patients and their own care providers. And so that's a great resource as well. I want to say it's not necessarily limited only to lung, but is often in lung that they focus on. And then there are tons of advocacy groups, especially for biomarkers, biomarker-driven lung cancers particularly, that are for EGFR, ALK, ROS1. There are Facebook groups, and social media has been a tremendous help in getting patients connected with their biomarker-associated group and colleagues, which has been a good resource and really has been a positive approach that I've seen patients really benefit from.
Thank you so much. And anyone else want to comment on this?
I can just mention for Colon Town mm-hmm. Started as a Facebook group, but now it's a massive support network, and they have, just as was mentioned, sort of even smaller discussions of people with very specific profiles of their cancer. There are a lot of for colon cancer, though. There's also the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, et cetera, but Colon Town, I think, is a really nice one, and it's for patients only, so physicians are actually not included, so patients can kind of speak frankly about their experience.
Excellent. And this is an interesting question. It'll be the last question you'll take. I'll give this question to Dr. Cox. What is the true potential of actually curing cancer in the near future, less than 10 years, with all of the hype of AI?
Yeah, so the trouble with cancer is it's not really just one disease. So every cancer is kind of its own animal and its own particular kind of bird to fight. And so there are some tumors and some cancers where, you know, historically with a lot of the kind of targeted therapies, there have been really extraordinary responses. So one of the great examples is CML. So, you know, prior to the development of imatinib, CML frequently would progress to full-blown acute myeloid leukemia. And so with the development of that particular targeted therapy, which is really well-tolerated, a lot of patients will kind of live in perpetuity with kind of a low-level smoldering type of disease. I will say, you know, probably the best way to, quote, cure cancer is to catch it early and cut it out. That's probably the most definitive way. But again, each kind of tumor on its own is its own kind of particular thing driven by its own particular biology. You know, as we start developing and incorporating more and more AI tools to start looking at some of these maybe not so obvious patterns and whatnot, it'll probably be another tool in the quiver to basically help kind of guide treatment. To help inform our clinician colleagues to figure out what the next best step is. At least on the pathology front, the place where AI is probably going to go is to help out with a lot of the more tedious activities that we do in our profession. So one of the things that we'll do when we're scoring a particular tumor is to look at, say, things like mitotic count. It's very time consuming. It's, relatively speaking, pretty kind of tedious process. So at least in the short term, AI will have a lot of impact in that area. And again, as we start testing more and more tumors with larger and larger panels, we'll start seeing more subtle connections between relatively disparate cancer types.
So. Excellent. Thank you. I just want to thank all of our speakers. I'm going to ask them each to provide a takeaway from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Goldberg, then Dr. Foote, Dr. Marks, Dr. Slovin, and then Dr. Cox. So Dr. Goldberg, do you want to start?
Yeah, thanks so much again, and thank you all, sir, for participating. You know, my takeaway, again, is really that precision medicine is enabling us to provide a more tailored, individualized approach to give the best treatment for the individual patient with the lowest side effects, and then in some cases to even provide a specific targeted therapy for an ideally a specific alteration that is unique to the cancer cells themselves, and with the hope of getting better outcomes.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Foote?
Yeah, I echo that, and just would add for GI cancer, talk to your oncologist about when and what tests are appropriate. We are starting to test tumors even in the early stage settings, so stage 2 and stage 3. So ask your doctor what they think about that, and the last thing would be just ask if a reassessing after a certain period of time would be appropriate, even if you've had a test at one point in your journey.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Marks?
Yes, of course. If you remember one thing, for lung cancer, biomarker results are often just as important as the diagnosis. because they help us choose treatments matched for your specific cancer subtype. And so please know that asking these questions and any asking for additional education on biomarker testing is not challenging your team. It's being an active partner in your cancer care.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Very well said. Thank you. And Dr. Slovin?
Well, I would say that the most important takeaway is knowing that we now have tools that are very helpful in trying to reduce the likelihood that we are over-treating your cancer and causing side effects that can impact on your quality of life. So we are learning more about each individual cancer and how to treat it with what we would consider to be a much better profile in terms of how you will tolerate your treatment. So we look forward to, you know, building on what we already have to make your treatment a better experience.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well said. Thank you. And Dr. Cox?
Yep, and then my kind of final point would be, please realize that pathology does play a vital role in the establishment of the diagnosis and the prognostication kind of going forward. So if you have any questions about what are in those reports, feel free to reach out to the number that's in that footer and talk to the pathologist who looked at your case.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants who really asked such great questions. Now, we obviously didn't get to everyone's question, but we got to quite a few of your questions, which were really quite excellent. And I would just like to say that we don't want anyone to leave the program feeling that you're alone. We want you to know that you're not part of our community of support, and you've heard about a number of organizations that you can contact for your specific type of cancer, and we'll be sending you a SurveyMonkey evaluation that will include all the information we gave out about resources that you can access. But also, we have also learned that many of you have no difficulty reaching your healthcare team during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays seem to be challenging. So please always check with your healthcare team who is available weekends, evenings, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very happy new year, and thank you. Thank you all for your participation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.